Is there a particular example of something like that that sticks out to you?
Yeah, I'll pick the most egregious one. There's a long list, but it's Assistant Commissioner of the BC RCMP. He was Gold Commander CERG. They're like resource extraction protection group. He said multiple times that media at Ferry Creek has come up throughout the trial. He said multiple times media at Ferry Creek had unfettered access to the front lines. Multiple times on the stand. And like, it's so laughable on its face. I have too many examples to list of that not being true. But he said it, sworn testimony. So like, somebody should call that out.
There's an excerpt from a recent episode of The North State. Find the full conversation at host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2020, The End of Sport provides commentary, analysis, and interviews reimagining sport, society, and sporting cultures with academics Derek Silva in London, Ontario, Nathan Common Lamb in Fredericton, and others. On this excerpt from a new episode, the team unpacked the political activism of Olympic athletes. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to Out of Left Field, a show where your end of sport comrades share their takes on current issues in sport and justice. Sport is always political. Neutrality is a lie used to sanitize exploitation and sell the commodity spectacle. We're here to expose the power dynamics the industry tries to hide and destroy the illusion that a game is ever just a game. This is the end of sport. This is Out of Left Field.
Hi, friends and comrades, and welcome to our third episode of Out of Left Field on the End of Sport podcast. My name is Nathan Coleman Lamb, and I am joined by all my friends today. We're not going to spend a lot of time on introductions, but I want you to hear everyone's voices here. So I'm just going to throw it to different people. Just say hi with your voice, so people get used to your voices. We got Anna.
Hey, how we doing?
Great, Priyash.
Yeah, Vivanha. So much has happened in the world of sport. I can't wait to talk about it.
Johanna.
Hi, so glad to actually be able to join you all. Last time I was like shoveling my car out, so I'm glad that it didn't snow for this.
And Derek.
I'm also glad it didn't snow and we could all be here. And wow, we have a jam-packed episode today, I think.
We do. We have tons of stuff to talk about, and we really appreciate it. We got a couple questions from listeners, which are going to kind of sort of help shape our conversation, because we had a lot of things we wanted to get to anyway, but these are perfect questions to sort of allow us to dive right in. So the first one, we got a question about, they just want to know, what is our analysis of Bad Bunny at the Super Bowl? The Super Bowl halftime show yesterday, swept the world. It's on YouTube now. If anyone hasn't seen it, you can just watch the halftime show on its own. It certainly dwarfed the Kid Rock Turning Point USA halftime show.
Apparently, even Trump. It's T-Pussy, Nathan. Thank you.
And I said that to everybody. If you're unfamiliar, it's a hilarious kind of TikTok that is making its rounds. So I urge you to look that up. But yeah, I sent that to everyone I knew last night.
So even Donald Trump watched the Bad Bunny halftime show, because you could actually see, I don't know if he was in Mar-a-Lago or wherever he was, but you literally can see him in the room. Not only was he like tweeting about it and also about like why football isn't dangerous enough for his taste, which is like such a Donald Trump taste take. But no, he was there. He was watching Bad Bunny. You were watching Bad Bunny. Tell me, what did you think?
The thing that really stood out to me, I'll jump in because a very, very good friend of mine, her partner is from Puerto Rico, actually. And so I always go to them. They saw Bad Bunny in concert in Puerto Rico. And I went straight to them. I was like, what did you think? And they both were like 10 out of 10, no notes. And so I think it was really, it really, I think, did a beautiful job showing Puerto Rican culture. And I think the thing that really stood out to me was the focus on community. And I think that, especially in the US, we focus on the individualism, we focus on the superstar, the main the headliner of the Super Bowl halftime show. But I thought what was really telling about Bad Bunny is when he had the different folks come on, Lady Gaga, Ricky Martin, even like the big house party that was going on, I didn't know where Bad Bunny was during that. It was focused on these supporting characters, but they weren't supporting. They were the main show in that moment. Bad Bunny gave them that space. And I think that is such a good pushback against what we normally see in Super Bowl halftime shows, like sharing the stage so magnanimously, but in a way that it is a collective effort. That's what really stood out to me, I think.
One of the things that, so I was looking at a lot of the commentary on, you know, what followed the halftime show. And so there's this weird mix of reactions where a lot of people who are actually fairly well-versed with Bad Bunny's music, they're able to, you know, relate to some of the themes that he talks about. Obviously, he talks about, you know, U.S. imperialism in Puerto Rico. But then there is this whole bunch of people who have maybe never heard of Bad Bunny, are maybe, you know, are not as well-versed in Spanish, cannot really understand what he's singing, but they just own the only lens through which they understand him is the fact that the right wing is attacking him. And this, he's now become a hero for them without actually relating with what he wants to talk about. I mean, many of these people would identify themselves as liberals, are, you know, more than happy to share social media posts or reels with, you know, Bad Bunny soundtrack, Bad Bunny songs, giving the soundtrack to their posts, but are not really concerned with thinking through the politics of it. I mean, there is one thing that I was wondering, you know, there was a lot of like speculation ahead of the halftime show about what will Bad Bunny say, because obviously when he was at the Grammys, he said Ice Out, and he's, you know, been quite vocal about Ice. Notably, he did not have a U.S. city on his previous tour. Yesterday was more about like peace and love and, you know, the greater America. I'm sure, like, you know, the historian Greg Grandin must have enjoyed it. But the fact is that at this point, as we see, you know, with the ICE operations ramping up, how is this being received in terms of his political message? Because if his message is mainly for those social media posts which I mentioned, then what is the politics of you know, performing in a, which is basically a, I mean, you know, we understand Super Bowl to be this kind of American, like, you know, one of its great far right spectacles, and pushing, and like Anna usefully, you know, analyzed it for us, like he's pushing back against it. But how are these messages being received is something I'm curious about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily have a strong critique of the performance. I thought the performance was quite good. Bad Bunny is like sick as a performer. It's wonderful to watch, but more so just a critique of the place of a halftime show in late capitalism. And this critique extends to every show ever. It offers a textbook case study in the contradictions of late capitalism. We see this like gesture to resistance, all of these like gestures to the colonialism that's crippled the Puerto Rican labor force. Of course, we see those things, but it's simultaneously serving as this like halftime lubrication for the NFL, which is like one of the biggest advertising machines. And ultimately, like, I think we have to think of folks like Adorno, Theodore Adorno, who've written about this and said, like, the culture industry is not the art of the consumer, if you will. It's a projection of the will of those in control onto their victims. And anytime I watch the Super Bowl halftime show, I'm thinking about that. We see these forms of resistance. Green Day opened the Super Bowl, and they've been like, oh, they put MAGA in one of their lyrics, so therefore we're seeing some change. And the flip side of that is like, what will actually change in this? What will actually stimulate any difference? Or is it just representation? Is it just something that's out there that allows people to pacify or get some sort of alleviation from their alienation that they experience in the day-to-day world? There's that contradiction. It's like, okay, we're showing you these like the backdrop of like sugarcane stalks to start, that gestures to this kind of like plantation economy that we know, but you're actually you're performing in a show that is meant to sell like light beer and whatever else to consumers, that's actively harming them and keeping them you know, alienated workers. So it's this juxtaposition that we and I think that's a useful frame for not analyzing or not critiquing Bad Bunny as a performer, but critiquing the place of anyone in that particular role of the actual spectacle being harmful.
Do you feel like, though, it's a contradiction or it's a subverse, like a covert way to resist? Because, like, you can't get a bigger stage than that. And I feel like that hype around, like, Bad Bunny, Green Day, like, I wanted Green Day to just, like, bring in those lyrics that they had 2 days prior and, like, just go all out, but they didn't. And I was, like, disappointed at first, but I'm, like, actually, in similar with Kendrick Lamar last year, there are these very, very subtle moments of resistance, showing the sugar cane plantations, the light poles, like the electric, those are very, very subtle forms of resistance. And I like, it is a contradiction, like 100% when we think about like the stage of it. But for me, it's an incredibly clever way to keep the rebellion going because like, of course, pushing back and agency is loud protests in your face, but it's also the work that happens day to day that we don't see. And so like, there's an interest, like there's a lot there and I'm not, this is like beyond my scope of analysis, but it's an interesting, all the different things that are interweaving in that, the subtle, the overt, the capitalist, like NFL stage, but also the visibility of it as well.
I think part of it is that like, we don't like to add to what people are saying, I think it is very powerful. A lot of people clearly felt that it represents something that they, their lived experience, something that they wanted to say. I guess my hesitation, or I guess my curiosity is like, what's going to happen? How is this going to further, basically, how are people going to use this to further collective resistance, right? Is that, are people going to be, and part of this is my ignorance. I'm one of those like white people who doesn't really know that much about Bad Bunny. So that's totally me, although I'm not like a white liberal. But I think how do people carry this forward to actually use this as a symbol of collective activism? And I think the other thing that I, like a subtle critique that I saw, Christina Fryer, who I had on the show after the January 6th assault on the White House. We talked about Kleek Keller with Matt Hodler way long ago. And like she shared on her Instagram this morning.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, my thing is going off. She shared basically that like a lot of the Black Caribbean was left out of kind of his recitation of the different nations that are part of the Americas. Now, I did not watch. I watched as much of it as I could. So there very well are symbols that I didn't pick up on. But I found that to be like really interesting. So, yeah, those are kind of my thoughts.
Yeah, I appreciate those points. And just to add my own two cents, like, you know, I will try to follow up by quoting the equally eminent scholar, Jess Staley, former CEO of Barclays Bank, who in the Epstein files pointed out that in an email to Jeffrey Epstein, that actually the function of the Super Bowl specifically is essentially to, and I think this goes to Johanna's point, like to keep people out of the streets. Like if you've experienced your resistance in a kind of spectacular form, you know, it's like maybe satisfying, but what does it do ultimately, right? It's a way of like keeping, Staley contrasts it to Sao Paulo and like actual, like really ardent resistance in the streets. And I just, at this point here, this is where I'm at. It's not enough to be subtle or indirect, right? Like the violence is so extreme at this point that people are experiencing that the counter messaging, it has to be stronger. I'm also reminded, you know, in the last couple of days, Jaylen Brown, the Boston Celtics player, you know, he's having a great season in the NBA and he's perceived to be one of the most outspoken kind of political players in the NBA. Full credit to him for that. And people loved it. You know, 1.5 million people viewed a tweet. He said, there is great evil in this world. Don't be naive to it. You know, that's fine. You know, we know what you're talking about, kind of. But also, do we know what you're talking about? You have to be willing to name it at this point. It's just not good enough, in my opinion, like to be oblique with it. It's great to say, like, we all love each other. It's great to name what the Americas are. But you know what? It's also important to say what he said in the Grammys and to say that ICE needs to be abolished, that there is a secret police force that is brutalizing people in the streets of the United States every single day, and that something has to be done about it. He's got that stage. He's got the opportunity. Everyone is listening. And at this point, we know, like, even if they tried to censor him on television, right? Like, there's a ways in which through social media, that message would be delivered. To me, at the end of the day, the dancer Kendrick Lamar's dancer, who used anti-genocide protests last year, was a much more impactful use of the Super Bowl stage.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The End of Sport. Find the more than 170 episode archives wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. And let's highlight from a recent episode, journalist Seema Desai joins host Desmond Cole to discuss the costs of Canada's growing partnership with India. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. Prime Minister Mark Carney has just visited India, where he met with Prime Minister Narendra Modi to sign trade agreements and to signal a renewal of diplomatic relations between the two countries. While Carney was happy to talk business, he dodged questions about Modi's human rights abuses and about Indian agents who are believed to be surveilling and even killing Canadians, particularly in the Sikh community. As Canada looks for partners other than the United States, how should we be dealing with leaders like Modi? And how is Modi's far-right Hindu nationalist ideology influencing politics in Canada? Joining me to discuss all this is Seema Desai, coordinating editor at The Breach. Welcome, Seema.
Hi, Desmond. Happy to be here.
Thanks for being here. And as we get started, just a reminder to our audiences to like and subscribe if you want more bold journalism for transformation. Okay, Seema, on the heels of Mark Carney visiting India, the two countries released a joint statement that, among other things, says both countries will, quote, uphold democratic values, support inclusive growth, and contribute to peace, stability, and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific and beyond, unquote. These are nice words, but how do they square with the reality of Narendra Modi's rise to power and the nearly dozen years he has governed India?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty surprising to hear Modi, you know, so vocally, explicitly committed to democracy and peace when that's not really how he's been governing India. Modi's rise to power and the party that he's the leader of, the BJP, its governance of India has been very much marked by some pretty classic fascistic types of governance. So what we've seen from the BJP in India is things like the scapegoating of minorities. Modi has really risen to power by scapegoating Muslims. He has called Muslims infiltrators. He sort of implied or said explicitly that Muslims are likely to sort of replace or take over from the Hindu majority in India. And so he's really used Muslims and other religious minorities, including Sikhs and Christians, as scapegoats to sort of consolidate his power and justify a lot of the other things that he's doing. Some of those other things include attacks on freedom of the press. So there have been many reports of foreign journalists having their visas revoked when they criticize the Modi government. A lot of arbitrary detention and violence against local journalists in India who are also critical of the government. And there's also been this sort of classically fascistic expansion of police powers. So, for example, just last week, the UN urged the Indian government to investigate hundreds of reports of torture and extrajudicial killings by the police. And Modi has also granted immunity from prosecution to some police forces, like police forces in the disputed region of Jammu and Kashmir. It's not really a particularly democratic vision of India. It's not a particularly peaceful vision of India that Modi has been putting forward and ruling on.
Nevertheless, Mark Carney has decided that now is the time to really re-up this relationship. And a trade agreement that's been apparently in the works for many years was announced by the two countries before Carney left. Let's talk about that agreement and what's in it for each side, starting with Canada. What is in it for our country?
Yeah, so Canada and India have been working toward a free trade agreement. A free trade agreement has been on the table for Canada and India for around 15 years now, and it's never been achieved. And so in terms of what's on the table for Canada, you know, Canada is sort of being squeezed right now by U.S. tariffs. India is one of the biggest countries in the world by population, and it has a lot of stuff that Canada wants, from technology, weapons, agricultural products, all of that kind of stuff. And so there is a lot for Canada to gain, especially given Carney's current project of like middle power politicking. And so that's a little bit of what Canada wants when it comes to trade with India. And a lot of, you know, the trade with India is driven by fear of Russia and to some extent wariness of China as well, and seeing India as a friendlier, safer trading partner.
And what about the Modi government? Why do they have an interest in announcing these new expanded trade agreements now?
So the Modi government is also being squeezed by Trump's tariffs. So last summer, Trump slapped about 50% tariffs on many goods imported from India. And so India prizes a lot of the goods that Canada can import to India. Some of the things in this trade deal include uranium from Saskatchewan, which will be used for nuclear power generation in India. It includes coal from BC. It includes also lentils and potash from Saskatchewan. And so Canada has some particular products that India wants, but perhaps more than that, this is a symbolic move by India and by Modi. So India has kind of been on this tear of signing trade deals with multiple countries. In the last few years, Modi has signed 9 free trade agreements covering 38 countries. And so, you know, in some ways, we can really see this symmetry between how Carney is moving, where he is doing a lot of middle power politicking and signing this whole spate of trade deals after being squeezed by Trump's tariffs. And India has been doing the same thing for longer than Carney has been doing it. And even beyond that, I think one way that India really values diplomacy and trade with Canada is that Canada can exert enormous power to legitimize India. India sort of, you know, is seeing itself as becoming a developed country. The idea for India is that by the 2040s, 100 years after the end of colonization, British colonization in India, India wants to become developed. And so it sees itself as wanting to ally with developed countries like Canada, but also gain the legitimacy that a democratic country like Canada can give to India, which is nominally democratic, calls itself democratic, calls itself the largest democracy in the world. But in many ways, its democratic credentials are pretty questionable because of the ways that Modi has come to power and consolidated power and these kind of fascistic ways that he's been repressing dissent in India.
Well, Carney has made it clear that the relationship, as he has said, with the United States will never be the same again, and that Canada needs new trading partners because of the antagonisms that we're facing, the trade restrictions that we're facing. And in his famous Davos speech, which you mentioned, he called for better relations between the so-called middle powers. So in December, Carney went to the United Arab Emirates and announced a big trade agreement there. And the UAE is a country that is known for its deplorable treatment of migrant workers and its complicity in the war with Sudan. And so now here he is strengthening ties in India, a country that is terrorizing religious minorities and expanding police powers, among other things. You've observed that Carney's commitment to strengthening middle powers doesn't exactly mean holding them to a higher standard. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, you know, we've all heard or read about the famous Carney Davos speech. And something that's interesting about this speech is that it is almost kind of a hologram, in that if you look at it from different perspectives, it means different things. So you can look at it and hear that Carney has said that we're building a new world order based on respect for human rights, based on sovereignty and territorial integrity. And then you can look at it another way and also hear that Carney said that we are taking the world as it is. We are not waiting for the world to become more just than it is or more fair than it is. We are pursuing this kind of economic realpolitik. So I think a lot of people heard what they wanted to hear from the Davos speech. And it was left ambiguous deliberately in that speech whether Carney is going to be moving to prioritize international human rights or if he is going to be moving to prioritize Canada's economic position. And so I think what we will see is that the proof will be in the pudding. How Carney actually acts will be how we should interpret the Davos speech. And what we're seeing right now, signing these massive trade deals with the UAE, even as the UAE is actively fueling the genocide in Sudan, and now, you know, pursuing this enormous trade deal with India, even when India and Canada were in this huge feud over Canada's own territorial sovereignty, its own sort of judicial sovereignty, a year ago, 2 years ago, shows that really where Carney's priorities lie are in economic realpolitik.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The Breach Show. Find new episodes at breachmedia.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's progressive journalism aggregation website, featuring more than 30 publishers. You can get all your Canadian news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 89 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. Birds in the subtropics of the Andes Mountains have to be creative to get their share of food from the forest. To outsip their competition, sword-billed hummingbirds have a distinct adaptation. These birds' beaks are longer than their bodies. Found in the temperate forests from Venezuela to Bolivia, these hummingbirds have co-evolved with various flower species to create a niche food source. They rely entirely on tube-like flowers that other species could never reach. While their sword-like beaks are handy for reaching a snack undisturbed by others, a beak that long doesn't come without challenges. For one thing, it's difficult to keep clean. The solution? Sliding it back and forth against tree branches, like a knight, sharpening their blade. Then there's the problem of cleaning their feathers. Most birds can easily use their tongues, since they don't have a big, awkward beak to get in the way. Instead, sword-billed hummingbirds put their flexibility to the test and clean themselves with a good old scratch from their legs. So one big adaptation leads to new challenges. But these clever birds are up to the job. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.